So, good evening, and good morning. We come tonight to the 28th chapter in the Life Divine. This is the first completely new chapter that we've met in our reading. We're not simply going through The Life Divine as published in the Aria, but The Life Divine is published in book form in 1939 and 40, which we still read today. If you remember, Sri Aurobindo gave a prefatory title to book one of The Life Divine, Omnipresent Reality and the Universe. This is the last chapter of that first book. It will probably take us 4 weeks to move through this material. It's rich, it's dense, but book two will certainly feel like a challenge. Its prefatory title is The Knowledge and the Ignorance, the Spiritual Evolution. Chapter 28 had to be written, supermind, mind, and the overmind, Maya. His experience did not cease with the cessation of the journal Arya. His experience continued to grow as he continued his ascent into higher regions of awareness and conscious power. Sri Aurobindo made many new discoveries about layers, heights of awareness, ranging above the mind, leading almost like steps towards what he called the supramental consciousness. And as he experienced those planes, he essayed their heights, their depths, what their purposes were. And it was critically important to his understanding of how the universe worked, because something had to account for this dramatic lapse out of the supramental oneness and diversity into a manifest universe that we deal with, where diversity has become division, where oneness has been lost. What really would explain that? What precipitated this action, this cosmic action? He has begun with the asseveration that there is a conscious existence whose nature is delight, what he calls Satchit Ananda, and that from this teeming infinity of Satchit Ananda is arranged a coordinated expression in cosmic form, which he calls the supramental, governed by ideas which are real. They're not insubstantial floating around sorts of things. Rather, they have conscious power within them. They are expressions of conscious power, and because they come from Sat, they are real. They are true, necessarily so. And this oneness which is wrapped in ananda, delight, expresses itself richly in this supramental plane of existence. Oneness expressed diversely, the diverse always looking back to the one. And then, of course, he's found that these various truths of Sat, of Chit, of Ananda, of the supramental, have themselves densified and become part of this omnipresence which is in matter itself. Not only is matter the final stage of an involving spiritual conscious being, but it is the beginning stage of an evolution back in all these seven chords of being, matter, life, mind, supermind. Climb back to the origination as Satchit-Ananda. But one thing was missing, which we've spoken about, the principle of Ananda. How is that represented in the cosmos? It's represented here in the principle of the soul, in the principle of the psychic being, who evolves back towards conscious suzerainty and governance over a world which has been made divine. So the soul is the promise of the future. It looks to be hidden inside, insubstantial, indistinct. We see, when we look, only the ego. We peel that away, there seems to be nothing there. But there is a psyche at the root, and its driving force, its whole raison d'être, is to experience and discover bliss in all the world, and to release it, to unchain it, to reveal it. So, Sat manifests as matter. The real becomes matter, stations itself at what seems to be oblivion. Chit tapas becomes the life power. The supramental becomes the mind, divisive but always at its own pure plane, in service to the supermind, but a delegated power thereof. And Ananda stations itself in the world as the supportive world soul, in the individual as the climbing, the ever-aspiring psyche. So this is the way the universe looks to us, but why this lapse from supermind into the ignorance of mind, just abruptly? So he feels it necessary to come back and treat this. Before he does, he throws in front of us some wonderful citations, both from Vedic origin and from Upanishadic origin. The first one is from the Rig Veda, book 5. It's the 62nd hymn, and it's the first Rig, the first verse. There is a permanent Dhruva, a truth hidden by a truth, Ritena Ritam, and the word hidden, Apihitam, where the sun unyokes his horses. The 1000s of his rays come together, that one, Tad Ekam. I saw the most glorious of the forms of the gods. This is an experience of the illimitable. As one rises, finally there is this vision of a truth hidden by a truth. So you go through what seems to be real, what seems to be true, and you find above and beyond it a still greater truth. And that's where you find the infinite, the 1000s, the 1000 number, throughout the Indian tradition, including the Tantric, represents infinity. The second citation is from the Isha Upanishad, with which we're quite familiar now. The face of truth, Satyasya Mukham, is hidden, again that word, Apihitam, by a golden lid, Haranyam Mayena Patrena. That remove, O fostering son, for the law of the truth, Satyadharmaya, for sight. So the invocation is that, having discovered, having seen, that there is this golden lid standing between the aspiring soul and that absolute infinite beyond, praise for the removal of that lid. O sun, O soul seer, Marshal thy rays, gather them together. Let me see of thee thy happiest form of all, that conscious being, that Purusha, everywhere, he am I. And then a simple declaration from the Atharva Veda, the truth, the right, the vast, Satyam Ritam Brahat. Finally, a citation from the Taittiriya Upanishad. You'll remember that it's been cited many times as the crowning declaration that bliss is the cause, the sustenance, and that into which the universe dissolves when it goes hence, can be called, is called, the Upanishad of Delight. This citation says, it became both truth, satya, and falsehood, anritta. It became the truth, satyam, even all this that is. So all this is, and it is an expression of truth, of true being. Satyam comes from sat. The truth comes out of true being. Falsehood here is anritta. Remember, ritta is the word for the right ordering of things. Sri Aurobindo has assigned its particular meaning to the supramental plane of consciousness, which draws from the infinity of Satchit-Ananda and orders it. And ritam is that cosmic law of perfection in the ordering of the diverse. So the first citation shows us the ascending soul, and so does the second. In the last one, though, we see the descent, the manifestation. It became the truth, even all this that is. The cosmos is real, valid, and genuine. So, we can now, I think, begin the chapter. One point remains to be cleared, which we have till now left in obscurity, the process of the lapse into the ignorance. For we have seen that nothing in the original nature of mind, life, or matter necessitates a fall from knowledge. It has been shown indeed that division of consciousness is the basis of the ignorance, a division of individual consciousness from the cosmic and the transcendent, of which yet it is an intimate part, in essence inseparable, a division of mind from the supramental truth, of which it should be a subordinate action, of life from the original force, of which it is one energism, of matter from the original existence, of which it is one form of substance. But it has still to be made clear how this division came about in the indivisible, by what peculiar self-diminishing or self-effacing action of consciousness force in the being. For since all is a movement of that force, only by some such action, obscuring its own plenary light and power, can there have arisen the dynamic and effective phenomenon of the ignorance. So this division is traceable throughout all the planes of existence, from mind, through life, and down into matter. What is its cause? So, this new chapter has to be written based largely on his broadening and deepening experience. note that it is only some self-diminishing or self-effacing action of the conscious being who could achieve this. In other words, if this has happened, it is not accidental. It is not something that has been imposed on the divine as a being coming out of the fullness of perfection. Any choice that it makes, and this must be a self-chosen action, must be deliberate. It is volitional. It is not accidental. It's not that it was walking along and whoops, dropped the crystalline universe and it smattered into pieces. So to analyze that would be one path that we could take right now. But he says, but this problem can be left over to be treated in a more close examination of the dual phenomenon of knowledge-ignorance, which makes our consciousness a blend of light and darkness, a half-light between the full day of the supramental truth and the night of the material and conscience. In other words, we'll get to it. Remember, the next book is called The Knowledge and the Ignorance. So indeed, we will have a look at this topic. It is a hint of things to come. Remember, that series of chapters hasn't been written yet. All that is necessary to note at present is that it must be in its essential character an exclusive concentration on one movement and status of conscious being, which puts all the rest of consciousness and being behind and veils it from one movement's now partial knowledge. It is through that exclusivity that the lapse into ignorance comes. And remember, ignorance to ignore. So when we fully focus on only one thing and forget the rest of our being, we become that. So it is not a weakness, it is an aspect of full power to be able to do that and yet not lose the context. We, operating in the ignorance, look for the context. The divine has not lost it. Still, he writes, there is one aspect of this problem which must be immediately considered. It is the gulf created between mind as we know it and the supramental truth consciousness of which we have found mind in its origin to be a subordinate process. What accounts for this gulf between them? For this gulf is considerable, and if there are no gradations between the two levels of consciousness, a transition from one to the other, either in the descending involution of spirit into matter, or the corresponding evolution in matter of the concealed grades leading back to the spirit, seems in the highest degree improbable, if not impossible. So he must bridge this perfect consciousness of the supramental through various stages to arrive at the imperfection of mind. Otherwise, we leap in a sense from spirit to matter. How do we get there? That's dualism. And that is a dualism which has plagued philosophies throughout the ages. Sri Aurobindo is trying to arrive at an integrated philosophy in which matter and spirit are not enemies, but are shown to be absolutely the same thing, ultimately. There cannot be anything other than the one reality. Sat-chit-ananda is what we call it, but what it is in its unknowable reaches is beyond all definition, beyond all mentation, beyond all philosophy. Yet we've assigned ourselves the difficulty of trying to express this philosophically, says Sri Aurobindo, and so let's give it a go. For mind, as we know it, he writes, is a power of the ignorance seeking for truth, groping with difficulty to find it, reaching only mental constructions and representations of it in word and idea, in mind formations, sense formations, as if bright or shadowy photographs or films of a distant reality were all that it could achieve. In other words, at a distance, and not from identity, but as an object outside itself. Supermind, on the contrary, is in actual and natural possession of the truth, and its formations are forms of the reality, not constructions, representations, or indicative figures. They are not mere symbols, they are living embodiments and expressions of its being. So the mind seeks, supermind knows. The mind aspires for true being. The supramental is the truth of being. He continues, no doubt the evolving mind in us is hampered by its encasement in the obscurity of this life and body. And the original mind principle in the involutionary descent is a thing of greater power to which we have not fully reached, able to act with freedom in its own sphere or province, to build more revelatory constructions, more minutely inspired formations, more subtle and significant embodiments in which the light of truth is present and palpable. But still, that too is not likely to be essentially different in its characteristic action, for it too is a movement into the ignorance, not a still unseparated portion of the truth consciousness. There must be, somewhere in the descending and ascending scale of being, an intermediate power and plane of consciousness, perhaps something more than that, something with an original creative force through which the involutionary transition from mind in the knowledge to mind in the ignorance was effected, and through which again the evolutionary reverse transition becomes intelligible and possible. For the involutionary transition, this intervention is a logical imperative. For the evolutionary, it is a practical necessity. So how does mind, as a close adjunct of the supermind, sharing its felicity, sharing its knowledge, become mind lost in ignorance? Yes, it is the principle of absolute diversity, gives truth to each individuation, but when it's in the province near the supramental, it works well. It's when it leans away from it that the diversity swells in importance and the oneness is lost. Why does that happen? So he's looking for a bridging consciousness to account for this dynamic and cognitive difference in mind above, close to the supermind, and mind below, closer to matter, life, etc. And this might be remindful to you of Plato's idea of the demiurge, that there is a creative godhead who is not an absolute god, that can kind of shape things and get them going, but then in a way loses control of it. So he speaks of this creative power almost by suggestion in that way. But that creative power is not mind itself. Not mind as we experience it evolving upwards. Let's go forward and we'll see what he means. For in the evolution, there are indeed radical transitions from indeterminate energy to organized matter, from inanimate matter to life, from a subconscious or submental to a perceptive and feeling and acting life, from primitive animal mentality to conceptive reasoning mind, observing and governing life and observing itself also, able to act as an independent entity and even to seek consciously for self-transcendence. But these leaps, even when considerable, are to some extent prepared by slow gradations which make them conceivable and feasible. There can be no such immense hiatus as seems to exist between supramental truth consciousness and the mind in the ignorance. So it's too large and categorical a leap to explain away by that. And he's just given us a sort of a look at the teeming expression of evolving life upon Earth through these various regions of being, from animality to vegetality, etc. So he continues, but if such intervening gradations exist, it is clear that they must be superconscient to human mind, above the awareness of the human mind, which does not seem to have in its normal state any entry into these higher grades of being. Man is limited in his consciousness by mind, and even by a given range or scale of mind. So this suggests that mind is a larger sphere than we're willing to acknowledge, or can perhaps acknowledge. What is below his mind, submental or mental but nether to his scale, readily seems to him subconscious or not distinguishable from complete inconscience. What is above it is to him superconscious, and he is almost inclined to regard it as void of awareness, a sort of luminous inconscience. So there's an intervening creative power, he asserts. We're trying to find the lid or the bridge which must still be above the height of evolved mind and humanity. We must discover it. But above and below are both beyond the range of our normal mentality. So if it's in a superconscient realm, it may as well be inconscient. We can't see it. We're unaware of it. If it's below the line that we call mental, we dismiss it. And he's going to flesh this out in a way that I think is colorful. So, just as he is limited to a certain scale of sounds or of colors, and what is above or below that scale is to him inaudible and invisible, or at least indistinguishable, so it is with his scale of mental consciousness, confined at either extremity by an incapacity which marks his upper and his nether limit. He has no sufficient means of communication even with the animal who is his mental congener, though not his equal. A congener is of the same kind of nature, so animals are pretty much like us. And he is even capable of denying mind or real consciousness to it because its modes are other and narrower than those with which in himself and his kind he is familiar. He can observe submental being from outside but cannot at all communicate with it or enter intimately into its nature. So animals are mental, vegetables are not mental, and they're unreachable so far as mind is concerned. Or let us say the mental human is concerned. Equally, Sri Aurobindo writes, the superconscious is to him a closed book which may well be filled only with empty pages. Because we're stuck here in the mind, we look up, we view the superconscious, I don't get it. If so, they cannot act as links or bridges, and his evolution must cease with his accomplished mental range and cannot exceed it. Nature, in drawing these limits, has written finis to his upward endeavor. Finis means end or conclusion. So if the human mind is to be the judge of it, we're where we're at, there is nothing more to grow to. There's not much below us that we can contact. There's not much above us. And can we even have real dialogue with ourselves? Doubts and doubts and doubts. But when we look more closely, we perceive that this normality is deceptive, and that in fact there are several directions in which human mind reaches beyond itself, tends towards self-exceeding. These are precisely the necessary lines of contact or veiled or half-veiled passages which connect it with higher grades of consciousness of the self-manifesting spirit. So there are traces of transcendence in mind as we know it. First, we have noted the place intuition occupies in the human means of knowledge, and intuition is in its very nature a projection of the characteristic action of these higher grades into the mind of ignorance. So this means that intuition, when it's properly functioning in us, comes from above. It comes from those very superconscious realms of which we have no immediate awareness. If it can come into us, that means that there is some avenue by which it is reached here, which means we can trace our way back to that. It is true that in human mind, its action is largely hidden by the interventions of our normal intelligence. A pure intuition is a rare occurrence in our mental activity, for what we call by the name is usually a point of direct knowledge which is immediately caught and coded over with mental stuff, so that it serves only as an invisible or a very tiny nucleus of a crystallization which is in its mass intellectual or otherwise mental in character. Or else, the flash of intuition is quickly replaced or intercepted before it has a chance of manifesting itself by a rapid imitative mental movement, insight, or quick perception, or some swift leaping process of thought which owes its appearance to the stimulus of the coming intuition, but obstructs its entry or covers it with a substituted mental suggestion, true or erroneous, but in either case, not the authentic intuitive movement. So he's just described a weltering world of ways that the aping mind can jump in and try to intercede between this descending truth and the active awareness of us in the front. So we misinterpret. Even when we get an intuition, it's often dulled down by what receives it. And then there is the possibility that a rapid intelligence can emulate an intuition. It won't have the real immediacy, but it's pretty close. And can we distinguish that with our limited mind? Most often not. And the real flaw is that an intuition brings authentic truth. As he will describe later in the Life Divine, it is the edge of a ray of truth, something to that effect. For us, if we cannot allow the intuition to act in its nativity, that means it will be tempered by the medium into which it arrives. It's not the place to discuss this now, but intuition can act not only in mind, but in our other mobile and living parts. It can act in our life powers. It can act in the body as well. It is a higher consciousness which can descend into any receptive instrument. Back to the place of intuition in his argument, though, here and now. Nevertheless, the fact of this intervention from above, the fact that behind all our original thinking or authentic perception of things, there is a veiled, a half-veiled, or a swift, unveiled intuitive element, is enough to establish a connection between mind and what is above it. It opens a passage of communication and of entry into the superior spirit ranges. So this implies that if we're living currently at the level of the human mind, that evolutionarily to arrive at an intuitive power of consciousness would be the next evolutionary step, an immediate step, takeable now. There is also, he writes, the reaching out of mind to exceed the personal ego limitation, to see things in a certain impersonality and universality. In other words, to move from personal illumination towards the cosmic. Impersonality is the first character of cosmic self. Universality, non-limitation by the single or limiting point of view, is the character of cosmic perception and knowledge. This tendency is therefore a widening, however rudimentary, of these restricted mind areas towards cosmicity, towards a quality which is the very character of the higher mental planes, towards that superconscient cosmic mind which, we have suggested, must in the nature of things be the original mind action of which ours is only a derivative and inferior process. So if intuition is the first reachable level en route to the supermind and truth of being, and its depth can be matched by the breadth of the cosmic in the higher consciousness, we're setting the stage for the emergence of a greater truth in us, a sight that really sees, something that really feels outside of the personal context into the cosmic. Again, there is not an entire absence of penetration from above into our mental limits. The phenomena of genius are really the result of such a penetration, veiled, no doubt, because the light of the superior consciousness not only acts within narrow limits, usually in a special field, without any regulated separate organization of its characteristic energies, often indeed quite fitfully, erratically, and with a supernormal or abnormal, irresponsible governance, but also in entering the mind, it subdues and adapts itself to mind substance, so that it is only a modified or diminished dynamis power that reaches us, not all the original divine luminosity of what might be called the overhead consciousness beyond us. So a genius opens to powers of intuition, however they may be made palatable to human taste. This term overhead is the first time he has used this term in the book. It is something that in his correspondence, of course, his disciples are quite familiar with because he has long since been describing overhead planes of consciousness in letters to disciples answering their questions and demonstrating to them avenues by which they can ascend out of ignorance into knowledge. Finally, he writes, pardon me, I skipped a sentence. Still, the phenomena of inspiration, of revelatory vision, or of intuitive perception and intuitive discernment, surpassing our less illumined or less powerful normal mind action, are there, and their origin is unmistakable. Finally, there is the vast and multitudinous field of mystic and spiritual experience, and here the gates already lie wide open to the possibility of extending our consciousness beyond its present limits, unless indeed by an obscurantism that refuses to inquire or an attachment to our boundaries of mental normality, we shut them or turn away from the vistas they open before us. But in our present investigation, we cannot afford to neglect the possibilities which these domains of mankind's endeavor bring near to us, or the added knowledge of oneself and of the veiled reality which is their gift to human mind, the greater light which arms them with the right to act upon us and is the innate power of their existence. So he's demonstrated several ways in which this higher consciousness can reach itself into us through the power of intuition, directly implanting itself in the mind through the widening of the spirit so that it becomes one with the cosmic vast around, with a developing mystic and spiritual experience. All of these things offer avenues by which we can grow back towards those originating heights from which we came. I think this is a good place to put our marker for this evening. and we'll be continuing from this point. This is a good place because it's a nice transitional spot in his argument. So we'll continue with supermind, mind, and the overmind Maya. Next week, we will not work in this. I'll be in Maryland with a group of devotees and a circle of aspirants there. So our group in Pensacola will continue to meet, of course, and look at some of Mother's comments on the Life Divine. I think they'll be reading from Volume 9 in her collected works, around page 302, I think, is the beginning point on that. So we'll reconvene, not on the 11th for this chapter, but on the 18th, and I apologize for being absent for a week. I do have a passage selected from the Life Divine, if you'd care to hear it. This is from Book 10, The Book of the Double Twilight. Canto 4, The Dream Twilight of the Earthly Real. All opposition seems, and strife and chance, an aimless labor with but scanty sense, to eyes that see a part and miss the whole. The surface men scan, the depths refuse their search. A hybrid mystery challenges the view, or a discouraging, sordid miracle. Yet in the exact inconscience, stark conceit, in the casual error of the world's ignorance, a plan, a hidden intelligence is glimpsed. There is a purpose in each stumble and fall. Nature's most careless lolling is a pose preparing some forward step, some deep result. Ingenious notes plugged into a motived score, these million discords dot the harmonious theme of the evolution's huge orchestral dance. A truth supreme has forced the world to be. It has wrapped itself in matter as in a shroud of death, a shroud of ignorance. It compelled the suns to burn through silent space, flame signs of its uncomprehended thought in a wide brooding ether's formless muse. It made of knowledge a veiled and struggling light, of being a substance nescient, dense and dumb, of bliss, the beauty of an insentient world. In finite things, the conscious infinite dwells. Involved, it sleeps in matter's helpless trance. It rules the world from its sleeping, senseless void. Dreaming, it throws out mind and heart and soul to labor crippled, bound on the hard earth. A broken hole, it works through scattered points. Its gleaming shards are wisdom's diamond thoughts, its shadowy reflex, our ignorance. I may read that last sentence again when next we gather. It is so wonderful and a good place to start from. You've been very kind. Be with me again. Thank you, and to all of our friends on Zoom. Jai Ma. Namaste.